I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a conversation about the last big presidential campaign in Indiana when Robert Kennedy announced Martin Luther King's assassination standing on the back of a flatbed. But first, a day ahead of voting in Indiana and North Carolina, four words have become even more important in this race for president: gas tax and Jeremiah Wright. A closer look at two polls out today show while a majority of Americans said Barack Obama's relationship with Wright hasn't affected their positive opinion of Obama, they worried it would be a problem in the fall. And Clinton's plan to suspend the gas tax for the summer has become surprise issue number one in the campaign. That's all according to Rick Klein. He's senior political reporter for ABC News and author of the political blog The Note. He joins us from Washington. And Rick, the New York Times poll says nearly half of the people they surveyed did say they approved of the way Obama spoke out and distanced himself from Reverend Wright. So how can, where is the liability? Where are you reading the liability into this?
Well, looking at that poll, only a quarter said that it would matter, the way that he handled the Wright affair would matter a lot to their decision. But about half said it would matter a lot to most people they know. So that's something that pollsters use to try to get at the truth of a tricky question. So there's a possibility that some people are uncomfortable saying directly that they have a problem with his handling of the Wright affair, but they are willing to say, well, a lot of people I talk to, a lot of my friends do have a problem with it. So I think that may be a more true measure of the political damage. And we've just seen through a series of polls his national standing take a hit. We were at a point just a few weeks ago where he looked like he was the inevitable nominee, and Democrats were coming around to that per the polling, and it's gotten a lot tighter. And I think that all portends well for Hillary Clinton going into North Carolina and Indiana.
But I want to ask you something to that reaction to the polls. Isn't it also true, we've heard from pollsters, that often people say they have a perception of what other people think, and that perception may not be true? So a candidate has to overcome a perception about something before it becomes self-fulfilling.
And you can add another layer on that, is that primary voters and superdelegates certainly are making their judgments based on what they think the perceptions might be in the fall. So they may say, well, look, I don't personally think the Wright affair is a big deal, but I know that the Republicans, or I think that the Republicans, will make it a big deal. So that adds another layer of intrigue to the kind of calculations that go on here. Right. But, I mean, the very fact that we're talking about these two smaller states, North Carolina and Indiana, as being so critical, we never imagined it, just speaks to the extraordinary nature of this year.
Well, how about Hillary Clinton? Voters surveyed by The Times say she's pandering when she wants to suspend the gas tax for the summer. Analysts and Barack Obama say it doesn't, really add up to that much for the drivers, but costs the government way too much. She wanted to pay for it by a windfall tax on the industry, as opposed to John McCain, who hasn't pledged that. Has she been able to tamp down some of this?
Well, interestingly, she was asked yesterday on This Week with George Stephanopoulos whether she could name a single economist, a credible economist, who believed that this was going to actually benefit consumers, and she did not. She said, I don't believe the economists on this one. I think that it's time to try something different. I thought that was a telling moment. But look, if you're a voter, making around what the median household income is in this country on a budget, and you're seeing the price of the pump, and you have one candidate say, I'm gonna knock 10-15 cents off of the price of gas, that's a pretty compelling thing to vote on. Barack Obama's taking a higher road approach and saying, look, don't fall for politicians to tell you they can lower the price of gas. You need a long-term plan instead. But Hillary Clinton taking a populist appeal here.
Well, on the other hand, when she said she didn't believe in economists, somebody got up in the audience yesterday and said, well, I kind of think they know what they're talking about. And today, on the Today Show, she was asked, does this mean you're not going to have economists in a new Clinton administration?
Well, yeah, and that's where it starts to get tricky. She's got plenty of economists to advise her, very smart people, none of whom can be happy to hear her talk about how terrible economists generally are. But I think it's her attempt right now to try to relate to the common person, to say, I'm one of you, and we can't just depend on what elite opinion is.
Well, and just a quick note on John McCain. Frank Rich writes in the New York Times yesterday, where are, all the media reports and sound bites from McCain's controversial ministers, Pastors Hagee and Parsley? When is the media going to start reporting on that? He has been out of the spotlight.
He has. I mean, I think with that particular issue, I don't think there's any way to equate a 20-year relationship that Jeremiah Wright had with Barack Obama with the
Well, but some would say, we had this conversation last week, that McCain actually sought out these endorsements.
Yes. But clearly he has to answer for that, and I think it was a mistake. But I still don't see them as anywhere near the same nearly as telling about, you know, someone's mindset when you talk about seeking out an endorsement versus being in someone's pews for 20 years.
But he is appearing at a Chamber of Commerce event in North Carolina. It does seem, though, that tomorrow is the Democrats' big day.
Oh, no question. Yeah. And, you know, John McCain, just a question of whether he gets 70, 80, or 90%.
Yeah. Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, author of the political blog The Note. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, voter registration is up in Indiana by more than 160,000 since January. And the state is also expecting a record number of Democratic ballots cast tomorrow, more than the 477,000 that were cast in 92. And the excitement in Indiana is bringing back memories of an even older primary, 1968, when New York Senator Robert Kennedy made his last late entry into the presidential race on exactly the day when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and just weeks before Kennedy would also be gunned down. Ray Boomhauer has written a book about that campaign. It's called Robert Kennedy and the 1968 Primary in Indiana. It's fascinating. Ray is also the senior editor of the Indiana Historical Society's quarterly magazine, and he joins us from the studios of WFYI in Indianapolis for this look back. Ray, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Glad to be here.
And do you agree that, you know, this, it feels pretty exciting in Indiana, and this hasn't been that way for a long time?
It's been great, all the attention the state has been getting. We're not used to that. It's been 40 years since that last happened, when national media descended upon the state to gauge the reaction of Hoosier voters to Democratic candidates.
Well, let's take a look back 40 years. Robert Kennedy didn't enter the race until mid-March. Eugene McCarthy was riding a groundswell of young, you know, anti-war sentiment. Describe how the Democratic race looked back then.
Well, it was very tumultuous times in Democratic politics. You had three main candidates. After Eugene McCarthy's strong showing in New Hampshire, became within a whisker of actually defeating an incumbent president in the primary there.
Lyndon Johnson.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Robert Kennedy jumped into the race, and really the first primary available for him to enter to take on McCarthy and LBJ was the one here in Indiana. And it would look like it was going to be a three-person race with Eugene McCarthy, Robert Kennedy, and our own governor at that time, Roger Brannigan, as a stand-in. He'd be representing Lyndon Johnson in the primary. But then everything went topsy-turvy on March 31st when LBJ, in a nationally televised speech to the nation, announced a bombing halt in Vietnam and also announced that he wouldn't accept a nomination from his party for the Democratic nomination that year.
Right. So that would happen shortly after Kennedy appeared in Indiana. And Indiana voters then would be the first really to see this candidate. Put it a little in context for us. Of course, you know, Robert Kennedy is enshrined now, you know, after his assassination. But how did they view him coming into the state?
Well, Indiana really wasn't a strong ground for the Kennedy campaign in 1968. A lot of his advisors didn't think it was a good first step for him in his campaign. Indiana, of course, in the Middle West, more conservative, usually went for the Republican ticket during the national election. The last time we had, in fact, gone for a Democratic candidate was in the 1964 blitz by LBJ over Goldwater. And even Indiana Democrats were more conservative than the liberal Kennedy was. But Kennedy said, you know, I know this is a gamble, but my whole campaign is a gamble. This was the first opportunity for him to show off his campaign and try to knock McCarthy out with an early blow here in Indiana, and decided to enter the primary and test himself before Hoosier voters.
Right. Another concern of his advisors, you know, and along with being conservative, very strong Ku Klux Klan membership. The Kennedys have been criticized for coming late to civil rights, but come he did, Robert Kennedy, to civil rights issues. So let's set the scene. His campaign in Indiana really takes off on April 4th, 68. Note the date, of course. He speaks at Notre Dame in South Bend, makes an appearance at Ball State University in Muncie before about 8,000 students. Here he is at the beginning of that speech, making a joke about his brother, Ted Kennedy.
I was going to have buttons for all of you. You know, buttons with a picture on it. Which I thought would be marvelous, and I gave it to the assignment to my younger brother, Teddy, to get the button ready. And I gave that assignment to him, and then after President Johnson's speech on Sunday in which he said he wasn't going to be a candidate for president, I found that all the buttons had my brother Teddy's picture on them.
It that's not a remarkable speech, but there are some moments that jump out. He's asked about student deferments. He says minorities and students who can't afford to go to college are bearing the burden of the war in Vietnam. He says that's not fair. But you write there's another question from a young black man that jumps out at you in hindsight. This young man asked Kennedy whether he could justify his belief in the good faith of white people toward minorities. Here's Kennedy's response.
I think that obviously it's faith in white America. I'm also placing faith in black America. Let me just say, I think that there are, can I answer? I think that there are extremists on both sides.
And Ray, you know, this was so foreshadowing for what was going to be happening later that day.
Unfortunately, he heard the news later on that Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee at the Lorraine Motel. And it really hit him hard, saying, you know, he can't believe he just said this to this young black student. What is he going to think now, hearing that his one of his greatest leaders has been gunned down?
And as Kennedy also alluded to, there were now black activists who were calling for revenge. Stokely Carmichael is telling crowds in New York, go home and get a gun. When the white man comes, he's coming to kill you. Extremely suddenly, you know, tripwire times in Indiana. He has a speech scheduled. People don't want him to go make that speech.
That's right. City officials were worried that once this large crowd that had gathered at an outdoor rally, once they heard the news that King had died, they might turn violent, which had happened in a lot of major cities, including our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Businesses had been looted and burned. National Guard troops had been called out in a lot of major cities across the country. And even his own advisors were, you know, worried that violence might break out. But Kennedy decided he needed to go to the rally site and let these people know what had happened and maybe say some words that might calm them.
It's a very different time. You know, it's not as if he went with, you know, a 50-member police escort and motorcycle. He pretty much went by himself.
That's right. He had a couple motorcycle cops escorting his vehicle. He traveled with his campaign aide, Fred Dutton. And on the way from the airport to the rally site on the near north side of Indianapolis, he kind of mused to Dutton, you know, what can I say to these people? What can I come up with to let them know what had happened and maybe give them some comfort and hope for the future? So he jotted down a few notes on the back of an envelope. And when he got to the site itself, the words he spoke in his 5 to 6 minute long speech were those he had come up with on his own. They were not written for him by some speechwriter in an office somewhere, but words from the heart.
Well, but the very first thing he says when he gets up on the back of the flatbed is to break the news to the crowd, which largely hadn't heard it. Let's listen.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee.
Reaction from the crowd in Indianapolis on April 4th, 1968, after Robert Kennedy delivered that news. Historian Rayne Boonhauer's book is Robert Kennedy and the 1968 Primary in Indiana. When we come back, what did Kennedy say that night? Can you remember another presidential candidate ad-libbing about the ancient Greek hero Agamemnon? And later today, a heartbroken horse race follower on how that sport has to change. That's later. We'll be back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from Ray Boomhauer, Indiana historian and author of Robert Kennedy and the 1968 Primary in Indiana. Before the break, we heard Kennedy telling the crowd in Indianapolis that Martin Luther King had been assassinated. And Kennedy goes on to make this incredible speech from notes scrawled on the back of an envelope, 6 minutes long. Ray Boomhauer, I don't think you hear this kind of free-form speech from candidates anymore, you know, quoting the Greek poet Aeschylus.
Yes, these are words that were meaningful to Kennedy, I think, because of the grief he felt himself after the assassination of his brother, John Kennedy. He was at a loss, and he went back to the writing of the Greeks for some comfort, and the things he discovered for himself in this journey of recovery after his brother's death stood him in good stead when he had to face this crowd. And really, for the first time, he speaks about his brother's death. He speaks from the heart, and I think that's why the speech itself was so effective.
My favorite poet was Aeschylus. He once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own deep despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
And Ray, you write that he goes on to truly connect with people in Indiana, even though, his anti-war views are completely the opposite of many of Hoosier's political views in 1968. Indianapolis is home to the headquarters of the American Legion and where the John Birch Society was founded. And there's another point that you write about where he's speaking with medical students at Indiana University Medical Center. Somebody who observed it said, he's talking about things that they didn't care about, but he didn't stop.
That's right. He was always best when he was speaking to a respectful but kind of hostile crowd, and that was the case with the medical students. He'd earlier talked about the need for health care for the disadvantaged, and they were really hostile. Where is the money going to come from for all these programs you're talking about? And he was very pointed with them, saying, from you, and he talked about the fact that he didn't see a lot of African-American faces, a lot of poor white students weren't medical students. And while they were getting their degrees, poor young whites and African-Americans were bearing the brunt of the fighting in Vietnam. It really won their grudge and respect because he spoke his mind and really caused them to respect his views.
As one of the aides who observed it writes, he went yammering around Indiana about the poor whites of Appalachia and the starving Indians who committed suicide on reservations and the jobless Negroes in the distant great cities. And it wasn't as if Hoosiers didn't care. They just didn't know about these issues, but he forced them to listen. Meanwhile, Eugene McCarthy had been propelled by young people who were against the war. There was the whole Get Clean for Gene movement, cutting their hair so they could go out and campaign for him. He did not connect as well in Indiana. Let's listen to a little of an appearance in Rushville. This is about a week or so before the primary. Let's listen to Gene McCarthy.
But I've said that the first order in my case would be to try to bring the war in Vietnam to a quick and to an honorable conclusion. I think this can be done. I think it has to be done. And then to turn to deal with the very difficult problems which face this country, the problems of poverty in the rural areas, and also, of course, the right of the farmers of this country to have an income which is proportionate for what they produce and for what they contribute to the general good.
Ray Boomhauer, what went wrong for McCarthy in Indiana?
Well, at first, I don't think he wanted to spend a lot of time in Indiana. Before Kennedy had jumped into the race, he was going to spend, 3 days at most in the Indiana primary. And of course, when Kennedy started his effort in the Hoosier State, McCarthy decided that he would spend more time here. He kept going around and hearing about this poet and wondered if they were talking about his friend Robert Lowell or some other nationally famous poet. But instead, they were talking about James Wickham Riley. And he just could not connect with the Hoosier icon that is Riley. And his campaign was not very effective. Sometimes they would be hours late for their appearances. Sometimes they wouldn't show up at all.
And yet, we need to point out, Gene McCarthy did have a campaign song produced by Peter, Paul, and Mary.
If you love your country and the things for which it stands, vote for Gene McCarthy and bring peace to this our land.
So there is that, Ray Boomhauer. But it didn't help in Indiana. Kennedy won the primary on May 7th, 68. He got 42% of the vote. 31% went to the favorite son candidate, the governor. Eugene McCarthy finished third, 27%. The campaign continues. McCarthy wins the Oregon primary. In fact, more primaries than Kennedy did. But Kennedy scores that big win in California in June, before, of course, he is assassinated in California. Do you think, Ray Boomhauer, if Kennedy hadn't been assassinated, he could have won the nomination?
It was a very iffy proposition. While he was involved in this very bitter fight with Eugene McCarthy in all these primaries, Hubert Humphrey, Lyndon Johnson's vice president, had announced that he too would be running for the nomination, but his announcement came too late for him to be eligible to enter into any of the primaries. And while Kennedy and McCarthy were battling in all these states, Humphrey was going around to party caucuses and picking up a sizable number of delegates, enough to get him the nomination at the Chicago convention coming up that August.
And we know what happened there.
Yeah, it's kind
of a mess.
There.
And by the way, that's sort of a cautionary tale for the two Democratic candidates as they slug it out towards this summer, perhaps an Al Gore, you know, is on the sidelines. But what, just finally, what do you think? You're there. You're obviously your heart beats Hoosier, but. What do you think, you know, Indiana's role in all of this was?
I think it was a key role for Kennedy because if he had lost that Indiana primary, his campaign would have ended before he even got started.
That's Ray Boomhauer. His book is Robert Kennedy and the 1968 Primary in Indiana. And, of course, tomorrow, 40 years later, the state holds another important one. Ray, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And we want to also thank Ball State University and Minnesota Public Radio for some of the audio we heard today. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. And we'll switch to horse racing after the news, here and now. So, will horse racing change after the horrible and very public euthanasia of Eight Bells, the filly who ran her heart out in Saturday's Kentucky Derby only to fracture both ankles after she crossed the finish line second? Television viewers seemed more aware than announcers that something terrible was happening. Even the winning horse, Big Brown, seemed to know, tossing his jockey during the victory lap. Well, today everyone is paying attention, and animal lovers, sports analysts, and veterinary experts are asking some tough questions. Joe Drape covers horse racing for the New York Times. He joins us from Louisville. And Joe, we just talked about this last week. You said, and all horse owners say, horses love to run, but two horses in 3 years, Barbaro and Eight Bells, and that's just the two the public knows about. Is there something really wrong with this sport?
These things cannot keep happening. You know, they talk about bad steps and accidents, and that may very well be what happened. But really, until they assure the general public out there that this is a safe sport and that they're not abusing these animals, you know, people have a right to question if this should exist.
Well, let's talk about some of the questions being asked today. And by the way, I'm imagining those of you who do love the sport are heartbroken about this.
You know, everybody, I tell everybody this. There were tears, there were gasps in the press box. We're allegedly a salty, cynical bunch. It's the single worst thing we have to deal with. And, you know, especially now twice, two high-profile horses in big races. Yeah. It is just heartbreaking.
Well, your writing in the paper today is beautiful, but no offense. I'm going to go also to Jim Squire's article right below it. He's bred five stakes winners, and he writes, "The industry, first of all, has to stop demoralizing viewers with these tragic endings. It's emotionally disturbing, but..." He loves the horses. He goes on to say, through decades of evolution, this thoroughbred has become so fragile and he doesn't know what to do about it. But to start by breeding them, you know, to reverse the trend, is that one of the questions today?
It is. And I'm reporting a story right now about have we bred fragility into the breed? There has been a tendency to go with precocious, speed-throwing sires. These are not always the soundest horses. Unbridled Song, Eight Bells' sire, did not have a long racing career. He had bad feet. He came to the Derby in tough shape. I'm going to try to see if his offspring have been generally prone to injury.
You also quote people who say, look, these horses have to be better screened. We've got technology. We've got to do better diagnostic tests before the running and ferret out the horses that have even the slightest weakness.
Yeah, John T. Ward, who won the Derby with Monarco's old line horseman, told me a great anecdote, had a beautiful AP Indy filly, just didn't seem to like running this year, and he took her to a regular x-ray, didn't find nothing. Something bothered him. He sends him over to Riddle. She goes like basically a full-body MRI, and sure enough, she's got microfractures in three of her four legs. Now, that is something technology can help him find. You know, he will turn her out for 3 months, and she'll eventually come back to the racetrack. But that's the sort of vetting, you know, he called it, we got to start scanning these horses at the molecular level.
Well, Jim Squires goes further and says, if they get to the gate, don't beat them into the gate. You see that, and it's horrible for someone to watch, but more so for the horse. And he says if they don't want to get in the gate, then they don't want to run. Don't beat them in.
Well, and Jim is right. He's a tremendous horseman. He's a tremendous rider, as you pointed out.
Jim Squires also says, by the way, don't beat them when they're running.
You know, the whip is a very American thing. I mean, a lot of things are done differently in Europe, and some will say better. There is no whipping in Europe, or there's watching on the whips in Europe, and it has to be used judiciously. You know, there's very fine horse racing in Europe. I have no problem with going with no whips.
What about the age? Are they running too young?
Yes, I think two-year-olds are too young. They're not even adolescents yet. The three-year-olds we saw are the teenage boys at the Derby. You know, they're coming into their own. That's why they get good about this time of year.
And let's just touch on the surfaces as we did last week. That's a big debate. Some tracks have switched to the synthetic surfaces. There's information coming in that those are better for the horses. The Kentucky Derby was a hard-packed dirt. Is this horrible tragedy on Saturday going to make these tracks switch? Or, you know, some people say, nope, that's tradition.
Well, they've already switched. Now, Barbaro really did usher in the era of the synthetic surface. Two of the three here in Kentucky are synthetic. All of California are synthetic. Arlington and Chicago, which Churchill owns, are synthetic tracks. And it looks like the very, very early data, which scientists warn are inconclusive, is that it looks a little bit safer, 1.47 per thousand breakdowns versus 2.03 on the dirt. Give the industry a little credit there for after Barbaro of getting on the stick and getting some of this stuff done. Yeah.
Another question, whether or not more attention should be paid to medications that are given to horses before the race to mask injuries. I mean, why can't that just be prohibited? Why can't they be tested?
You know, they are tested, and the medication rules have gotten far more uniform. They are far more stringent this year than they were last year and far more than the last 5 years. That has been a movement within the industry. You ask, I ask, a lot of people in Europe ask, is why medications at all? Why not hay, water, and oats, is the old saying. And again, these sort of incidents are going to make them think hard about these things and push, I guess, you know, push their competitors, push their, and when I talk to competitors, the human competitors, say, you know, look, we got to do something a different way. As Jim said, you know, they can't be breaking down these horses on national television and expect any empathy, let alone sympathy.
Well, and yet we should say something else that Jim Squires and other horse owners are saying today, that horses are a fragile lot in many ways, that, you know, when they play with each other in pastures, they injure themselves. When horses, you know, break legs, more often than not, they have to be euthanized, and it happens more often than people know.
That's absolutely right. I mean, and Jim used an analogy. He talks about a little foal chasing his mare in his field, and I've been to his farm. It's a great green pasture, and he says watching that is not like unlike watching your little kid run into the street. I mean, they are fragile little animals, and you know, life is precious, as we all know. How this relates to the horse racing is it should make everybody say, hey, we ought to be beyond reproach about what we're asking these animals to do. And I think they got to move that way. I mean, again, I'm not going to castigate them all the way, because after Barbaro, a lot of money went into technology, went into the synthetic tracks, went into the study of medications. So, you know, they're moving the needle. It's unfortunate what happened to Abe Bells. If you can put a silver lining in this thing, is they just got to kick up and, you know, think about the drastic reform.
That's Joe Drape. He covers horse racing for the New York Times and is also the editor of To the Swift. It's a collection of writing from the New York Times on the Triple Crown winners. And, Joe, thanks so much for speaking to us today. Tough day.
Robin, I wish it was under better circumstances.
Okay, some of the stories in the works here at Here and Now. Foster care. How much should the public know about abuse? Also, a highly controversial topic in the deaf community, hearing after decades of deafness. A married couple gets cochlear implants. Their reactions to hearing fall on two sides of this really heated debate. We'll also take a look at the status of Al-Qaeda and bluefin tuna on the endangered list and on your menu. These stories all coming up in the coming week. And in a few minutes, coming up, the Fonz. You're listening to Here and Now. The band Portishead hails from the small town of the same name in southwest England. In Britain, that's kind of like being from Normal, Illinois, a place many might think too far out in the country to be hip. But throughout the 1990s, Portishead carved itself an elite spot, winning critical praise for spinning turntables and samples into spiky musical cocktails. Here now, music critic Tim Riley explains why Portishead's first release in almost 9 years has been worth the wait.
That's the opening track from the new Portishead CD, Third. And from there, things just get creepier, as if there's emotional fungus growing on the music. Portishead composers Adrian Utley and Jeff Barrow came of age as the turntable mutated into an instrument of bold new special effects, and digital sampling put familiar sounds in elaborate new frames. Their challenge was to rework pop's raw material into music that sounded somehow natural instead of mechanical, tunes you wanted to hum. This style acquired the dopey catch-all name of trip-hop, and with its 1994 release, Dummy, Portishead conquered the scene. Portishead's Beth Gibbons doesn't sing songs so much as hemorrhage. The music is ornamental and repetitive. Gibbons gives everything a human scale, as though being submerged in digital gearwork gives her both pause and stature. The songs have technical savvy and a spaced-out tone, but with Gibbons at their center, Portishead's music comments on itself, machines so beautiful they break your heart. The more you listen to Portishead, the more you sense a wicked intelligence in these grooves, a new way to think about music, as if assembling a completely original narrative by re-editing somebody else's movie. The parts that don't fit only make everything else sound more organic. Portishead borrows heavily from rap, acid house, rave, and every other form of electronic tomfoolery that fueled 1990s pop. But they aren't just dabbling. They build huge, abstract mosaics of sound that seek ironic comfort inside Gibbons's trembling. With almost any other singer, you'd say Gibbons worries her lines, over-enunciates, over-emotes. But somehow inside this artificial context, this gilded sonic tapestry, she only sounds more frightened, more detached from whatever love affair she's grieving. There's a cinematic element to Portishead's computer textures that gives them a rare visual sense. Close your eyes, and each aspect of the musical mosaic takes on architectural shape, as though everything has been mapped out in three physical dimensions beforehand. Imagine Austin Powers producing Steely Dan on the soundtrack for a new Pulp Fiction movie that still needs a script, and creeping out Quentin Tarantino so much that he never shoots it. There's something both cheesy and redemptive about Portishead's affection for B-movie organs and guitars. The band's dream life is one long emotional slasher flick. But they fawn over their jaded Bond music so well, they send it soaring into a new place, like the score to a movie on an endless loop in its listeners' guiltiest fantasies.
Music from the new Portishead CD, Third. Review from Here Now's Tim Riley. And coming up, Henry Winkler on faking and joking his way through life with a reading disorder in 1 minute, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday,
when he took out a library card, millions of kids took out library cards. Now he's writing books, hoping the kids of those kids read books. He's the Fonz, Arthur Fonzarelli, Henry Winkler's character for 11 years on Happy Days. Winkler has had other acting roles. He's also directed and executive produced programs. But Henry Winkler has long been an advocate for kids. He's one of the founding families of the Children's Action Network. And Henry Winkler is an author. With collaborator Lynn Oliver, he's written a series of books featuring Hank Zipser, the latest, The Life of Me, Enter at Your Own Risk. It's the story of the fifth grader from New York with the sparkling personality, passion for the Mets, and serious learning disability.
If there's one thing on this whole earth that is unbelievably hard for me, it's reading out loud. I mean, I stumble over words, even simple ones that I know how to read. My eyes jump around on the page so much that I can't follow even a single sentence. I see words that aren't there. I leave them out. I mean, I leave the ones out that are there. It's really frustrating for me because I feel like I could read out loud with great expression if I could just get the words right and stop them from moving.
Hank Zipser. Hank is often short for Henry. Could it be? Yes. Hank Zipser is loosely based on the life of Henry Winkler, who joins us from his home in California. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
We asked you to do the reading from your book, and we were a little nervous about, you know, whether or not you'd want to, because you have revealed that you had a reading disability.
Reading out loud is my worst nightmare.
So how did you do it?
I know every word intimately.
Well, you know, it's funny because as you read it, I followed along on page 17 in the book, and you added a couple of words here and there.
Because he's got a personality, and sometimes I really want that on the page, and then sometimes the editor, you know, has to edit for whatever reason. So I tried to quell my frustration.
To quell your inner Hank.
Yeah, it's true. That's exactly right.
Did you always know you had a reading disability, or how?
No, well, I always knew that school was hard because Hank really is me. The reality, the emotion, the frustration of not being able to remember my spelling words from the night before in my apartment when I knew every one of them till the time I take the test in the class and I can't remember any of them.
Yeah. You, and in the back of this book in particular, it culminates in Hank Zipser's scrapbook that he puts together. And,
right, a school project right. with Mr. Rock, who is their substitute teacher. I had a Mr. Rock. He's real.
Did you also have a...
Miss Adolph?
Yes.
Yes, I did.
Well, how does she feel about how you write about her?
I think that she has passed on to the other side, but this woman was just mean.
And what'd she do?
She made fun of me. She would say, Henry, spell separate. And I said, do I have to? Spell separate now. All right, I know it starts with an S. Mr. Comedian, you're going to go to the principal's office. I never got a full sentence out before my tush was on the bench outside the principal's office.
But how did you make it through Yale?
You know what? If you want something, you try a little harder. The great thing about Yale is I didn't have to take an SAT to get in to the drama school. Hmm. I got 134 over my name in math. I am in the bottom 3% in this country academically.
And yet you, like Hank, I'm guessing, Hank works so hard trying to change the reality of his world so that he can cover up his disability.
To cover up the shame, cover up the disability, and succeed in some way. I always see myself as like that toy with sand at the bottom. You blow it up and then you punch it and it goes down and comes right back to center.
Yeah.
I would always come back to center trying to figure out, wait a minute, I want to do well. I'm going to sharpen my pencils even better today and let's see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was hard.
When did you find out that there was a name for what you had?
My stepson is 36 years old, Jed. He was studying the Hopi Nation.
Now, how old was
he? He was in the third grade. We drove across Arizona to visit the Hopi who live on the mesas in Arizona. And we had the most incredible time there. So we come home. He starts to write a report. It's only two sentences long. I say to him, everything that was said to me, Jed, try it again. You're being lazy. Come on. You're so smart. You can do it. And finally, we had him tested. And we found out that he had a learning challenge, and his eyes didn't track. The muscles of his eyes weren't strong enough. At that time, with his evaluation, I went, oh my, everything they're saying about Jed is true about me. I have something with a name. I'm not stupid. I'm not lazy.
Now listen, you had already been the Fonz at this point.
It didn't matter. You carry that mantle with you. That's why when parents say, what can I do? My kid has a learning challenge. I said, you love him from the moment she gets up until the moment she goes to bed. And you just keep telling that person over and over again, you are fabulous. Because the child knows they're not keeping up. The child feels bad enough. You don't have to add to it.
Well, and also perhaps you suggest, as you do in this book, the reading gym, which is what happens to Hank. He goes to something that Mr. Rock, his substitute teacher, creates. It's a reading gym, GYM, where he and fellow students go and do exercises.
And that's where he meets Zoe, his first crush.
And Zoe has that tracking problem you spoke of that your stepson had with her eyes. She ends up doing muscle exercises for her eyes to strengthen them. I know it was Gary Marshall's character or the show's character, but how much did your understanding of kids... Remember when the Fonz cried because some kids couldn't cry? There was some emotionally...
Yes, that's exactly right. Gary got a letter from a juvenile hall where they said, look, these kids love the Fonz, but they won't show any emotion. Maybe if the Fonz shows emotion, you can break through to them. So we did. I cried over Richie.
Richie was in the hospital.
One of my favorite episodes of all.
Yeah.
We did a lot of stuff in the midst of the comedy. I love the Fonz.
We love the Fonz.
As a matter of fact, the Fonz loves Hank.
Huh? How do we know this?
He wrote me, left me a note on the refrigerator saying, I think book 14 is really great.
Well, how does the Fonz feel about being attached to that line that has come to describe a television show when it's just lost its, you know, it's about to tip over into oblivion, it's lost its steam? I'm referring to
Jumping
the Shark.
Okay. There are several things about Jumping the Shark. One is we were number one for about 6 years after we jumped the shark. Number two is every time they mention Jumping the Shark, they always put a picture of me on my water skis in my swim trunks. And at that time, I had great legs. And number three, I am, and I'm very proud of this, I'm the only actor in the world that has jumped the shark twice. Once on Happy Days and once on Arrested Development.
And again, Jumping the Shark was when Fonz, you know, put on skis and jumped over a shark and some people...
Yes, we went to keep Richie... company in California.
Henry Winkler, it's radio, so we can't see the Fonz's signature thumbs up. What's the signature greeting?
You mean A?
Yeah.
You know where A came from? That was merely because they wrote too many words for the Fonz, and you can't be cool speaking like vast paragraphs, I thought. So I reduced a lot of language to sound.
And less reading as well.
And less reading. I never thought of that.
Come to think of it.
That is exactly correct.
That's writer, actor, director, producer, author Henry Winkler, his 14th book about Hank Zipser, the kid with a sparkling imagination and a learning disability.
Right.
It's called The Life of Me, Enter at Your Own Risk. It's just been published. Henry Winkler, thanks so much for talking to us.
You know what? I really enjoyed myself.
Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday.